Ready? Here we go. Third talk, jealous gods and animals. So yesterday we looked at the visionary appearance in the Bardo of the blue Buddha Akshobhya Bhadrasattva and the red Buddha Amitabha. When they appeared with their retinue, at the same time a dull smoky light shone from the hells with Akshobhya Bhadrasattva, and a dull yellow light shone from the hungry ghost realm alongside the appearance of Amitabha. And we had quite a good look at hell yesterday, and at hatred, and at the hungry ghosts and craving. And we concentrated more on those states of woe and how to liberate ourselves from them, rather than concentrate on the Buddhas themselves, which we'll be doing next week. Those of you who are staying will have that experience. I must just note here, it's very important, that I'm not following the proper sequence of the appearance of the Buddhas in the Bardo. The proper sequence is first of all Vairochana, then Akshobhya Bhadrasattva, then Ratnasambhava, then Amitabha, and then Amoghasiddhi. Next week, when we look at the Buddhas, we're probably more likely to follow that sequence. This week, because we're concentrating more on the six realms, I'm starting with the states of extreme suffering, first of all. Don't quite know why that is. I think it's probably something to do, well, let's get through that. And then, rather than end with it, let's get through it and move on up, so to speak, to quote Curtis Mayfield. Anyway. So for you Tibetan Book of the Dead aficionados, I am aware that I'm doing things out of sequence. So today we're going to jump to the fifth day in the Bardo. On that day, the purity of the air element, sometimes called the wind element, will arise in the form of green light, beautiful, rich, deep green. And from the green northern Buddha field called Matrix of Enlightened Activities, the Buddha Amoghasiddhi, with his consort and retinue, his consort being Tara, green Tara, his consort and his retinue manifests, and they're seated on a throne of Chivam Chivaka birds. These are half bird, half man, more often known in their Tibetan form as Shangshangs, clashing symbols. From the heart of Amoghasiddhi, a dazzling, radiant, clear and awesome green light shines piercingly towards your heart. It is so brilliant, you can't bear this deep, rich, luminous green. But this green light is the light of the all-accomplishing wisdom, the all-performing wisdom. At the same time as this dazzling green light shines, a dull red light shines from the realm of the jealous gods. This light is indicative of the realm of the jealous gods, the envious gods, the asuras. And the light is alluring and inviting and comforting. And that's so because of the mental poison of envy, of jealousy. And under the sway of the habit of envy and jealousy that you have in you, you feel attracted to that dull red light. You want to go there. You want to follow it. And the Lama, or the brother in the Dharma who's reading the Bardo Tadol to you, he tells you, don't go towards that red light. Don't follow it. Develop equanimity towards the dull red light. Don't be swayed by the dull red light. If you go after it, you'll be born in the realm of the jealous gods, and you'll suffer the pain of constant envy and constant warfare and conflict caused by envy. Instead, the Lama says, respond to the green light of Amoghasiddhi. Follow that luminous light path and gain enlightenment in his realm, in the realm of the matrix of enlightened activities. So here again, within the Bardo, within the open space, within the suspension, as it were, of being, two possibilities open up. On the one hand, reality, enlightenment, manifests as the Buddha Amoghasiddhi, infallible success, with his green light of all-accomplishing wisdom, his wisdom of creative, enlightened activity. It's very clear, very bright, awe-inspiring. On the other hand, the dull red light of envy, of jealousy, of the envious god shines. Envy, jealousy is another habit, even you could say another tactic, to shy away from the way things really are. Another way of preserving the status quo, another way of preserving safety. Sometimes when the new dawns, when the truth dawns, when change happens, we just want to fight it. We want to compete with it. It's scary. We don't want to admit that, so we compete. We want to show that we're big and strong and tough, so we compete with it. But somehow, in some way, it's making us feel small, perhaps. Maybe we're on a retreat, for example. We're in that space of a retreat, and you look round, you know, from time to time, maybe one day you think, oh, everybody else is having a good time. Everybody else in the meditation is probably in dhyana. And I'm not. I'm not having great meditations at all. Or, you know, everybody seems to be getting on with well with one another, and we're sort of sitting there at the meal table thinking, oh, no, I'm not getting on with anybody. So rather than relax and open up to whatever is happening, we can feel, if we're not careful, jealous, envious at others. We start competing with them, fighting with them, try to hold them down, hold them back, undermine them, kind of hold our corner. It can happen even when you're on your own. I was on a recent solitary retreat back in the summer, and doing quite a lot of meditation and study, you know, reading Living with Kindness, and, you know, doing lots of Metta Bhavana and all the rest of it, and going for beautiful walks every evening in this amazing scenery in our secret valley in Guijuelo in Spain. And I'd be walking along, looking at the bees and the butterflies, you know, on the hillside blossoms. And then suddenly, apparently from nowhere, going along into this open space, I'd be imagining a scenario where I'm in an intense argument with someone, and I'm putting them straight. I'm sorting them out. And of course, everything I'm saying is apparently expressive of my deeply held values and convictions and concerns. But the truth was, the reality was, I couldn't bear just being in this space. I couldn't bear this space opening up. It was too bright, too open, too beautiful, if you like. And this competitive aggression was a way of just closing it down, covering it over, making everything safe again. Traditionally, the asuras are powerfully built and muscular. They wear armour. They carry weapons. They're very fierce and very ugly. Asura men, the male asura is. Apparently their women are incredibly sexy, really voluptuous, extraordinarily attractive and very alluring and aggressively sexual. And human men, if they come across an asura lady, they'll often fall for them, but after the asura lady has had her way with a human man, she'll gobble him up, just like that. And no doubt Asura men do similar things to human women. So the Asura realm is like a military state. When you see on the Tibetan Wheel of Life sometimes paintings of the Asura realm, it looks like a sort of medieval version of a military state. It's a state in constant war. Everybody is bred to battle, to warfare. You can imagine the sort of, if you just happen to be a sort of weedy Asura, you're going to have a really hard time. You know, the ones with glasses, you know. Presumably you might find a way, being an Asura, of sort of, you know, working your way up to the top in a very manipulative sort of way. There is that kind of Asura as well, not the big muscular ones, but, you know, the ones with round glasses and things like that. But hang on, what am I saying? So it's a state of warfare and battle. It's and politicking. It's also apparently a state of intense sexual polarisation. In The Lord of the Rings, that film, The Lord of the Rings, the orcs, I think, are very good arsuras. They embody a kind of arsura very, very well. It's ruthless, just bred for warfare and militarism. And they don't care what they do to the world around them, to fight and to win. So traditionally the Asuras are in a state of constant warfare with the gods, with the Devas. Because the gods have something that the Asuras want. The Asuras envy the gods constantly. They're in a state of constant envy in relation to the gods. Because they have something, gods have something the Asuras want very badly, very, very deeply. Because the fact is, the gods can eat the fruit from the wish-fulfilling tree. In Indian mythology, there is a wonderful tree, a huge tree. Its roots are deep in the realm of the Nagas, the serpent deities, the deities of the waters. Its trunk is in the realm of the Asuras, so the trunk grows right through the realm of the Asuras. But the leaves and fruits grow in the realm of the gods, and only the gods can eat the fruits. Only they can fulfill all their wishes. There's a lot of symbolism there that's probably worth, reflecting on and meditating on a bit. So the Asuras are intensely jealous of this. They burn with jealousy. They have this overwhelming sense of injustice because they feel they have a right to that wish-fulfilling fruit because the trunk goes through their realm. And they're just filled with aggression. And their life is a constant play of devising strategies, manoeuvres, making weapons, new weapons, to break through into the realm of the gods to get the fruits of the wish-fulfilling tree. They can't chop the tree down because the tree will die and there'll be no fruits. So they're always trying to get into the realm of the gods. They're always trying to win, but the gods, they just can't get near them. They can't get into that realm. So the Asura state is the state of jealousy, envy, competitiveness, aggression. Others have what we want, and others will get, we think, what we want. So we want to pull them down, we want to fight them, we want to destroy them. Sometimes you can see this, people just resent other people's happiness. It's almost as if they feel, well, there's only, why should they be happy? Why should they be fulfilled? There's only enough happiness and fulfillment to go around, so they want to kind of pull them down, undermine them. The Asura realm isn't very far away. I said yesterday something about our world of consumption when I spoke about the praetors. Actually, you can also see that it's an extraordinarily aggressive consuming that goes on. We live in a world of incredible competition and competitiveness. And that puts people under enormous pressure and strain. This incredibly commercialized world puts people under extraordinary pressure and strain. I talked to two bus drivers recently. A cousin who's been a bus driver most of his adult life, and an older member friend of mine who was on the buses for a while, who gave it up. He just drove him nuts, and they said it's really unpleasant being a bus driver, and the worst thing of all is management. And they weren't, you can imagine, we're the workers. It wasn't that. So because there's this intense pressure on you all the time for productivity, and I thought, well, that's weird, a bus driver having to be productive, but this intense pressure all the time to respond to deadlines and all the rest of it. As well as dealing with aggressive passengers. I thought, this is incredible. This competitiveness, just seems to run through everything. All pervasive. So the Asura realm is the realm of big business. It's the realm of power politics. And it can be driven along by various isms and dogmas, religious fundamentalisms. nationalisms, class war, the politics of envy, and so on and so forth. We know it very well. Happiness, fulfillment is to be found in conquering, in victory over others, over the other, the enemy, the infidel, the heathen, the politically suspect. We just want to win, and then we will be happy. We will get everything that we want. We will have our wish-fulfilling tree. When everybody follows our religion, we will all be happy. When we kick out all those bad people, then we will be happy. But the truth is, if we're motivated by envy, by this hard competitive urge, we'll never be fulfilled. It's never ending. The competitive, jealous, envious urge is never ending, because alongside envy, alongside competitiveness, there is insecurity, there's fear, there's paranoia. We'll always want more. We'll always think there's still something over there. The Asuras will never get the fruits of the wish-fulfilling tree. They'll never get it through warfare. It's impossible. So we'll always want another victory. We can never relax. In the end, there's a terrible loneliness in it all. I think at the heart of an Asura, there must be a terrible loneliness and vulnerability, all encased in his armour of violence and aggression and relentless competitive activity. Inside there is a deeply lonely, vulnerable, fearful being. As you remember that end of the conclusion of The Godfather, I'll never forget that, where Al Pacino has basically sorted out all of the family's business. Everybody, all the rivals have been shot, even people within the family who had betrayed him have been shot, even his wife has been thrown out. And there's that incredible scene at the end where he's sitting in this sort of lakeside retreat, and he's just sitting there on his own, and you just, that sad music, that sad sort of Italian sounding trumpet starts to sound, and you just see him sitting there in this terrible isolation and loneliness. He's achieved absolute power, but there's this terrible, terrible loneliness all around him. Very, very sad. So we need to look into ourselves. We need to notice the tendencies towards being an Asura, our tendencies towards competitiveness. It happens in little things, comes up in those apparently little things, those apparently small things. Sometimes you get arguments, don't you, a sort of bickering, where somebody says, no, it's like this. No, it's not, it's like this. No, it wasn't like this. And it goes on like this, like a game of table tennis. I'm right, you're wrong, I'm right, you're wrong. It's not about the subject anymore. It's not about what you're talking about. It becomes about winning. It becomes about bending the other person to your will. It's about the other person assenting to your will. It's about subjugating that person. When I see myself doing this, when I catch myself, even if I'm right, if I'm in that mood, I'm wrong. I'm wrong. I'm so wrong. And if I feel so petty and pathetic. I'm not talking here about, a really good debate and discussion, even a good argument, trying to get through to the truth. What I'm talking about is this bickering and argumentativeness that goes on, which is essentially competitive. It's about winning rather than getting to the truth. I think you can see it also in fault finding, becoming excessively critical of others. I think that's Asuric. Whether it's expressed or not, I think that's the Asura mentality. You making yourself feel okay by constantly doing others down. By constantly kind of looking around, judging, putting people into categories, fault finding, looking at their faults. You're doing others down. You're winning at any cost, even if it's the cost of a terrible isolation. In the world of the Asuras, great compassion manifests as the green Buddha Vemachitra, and his insignia are armour and a sword. He comes holding armour and a sword, gear that the Asuras would think, oh, that looks like really interesting armour. That's a good fancy sword you've got there, you know. So he's coming to them with stuff, that gear, that they would be interested in. He gives what so, and what Vimachitra is doing actually, he gives to the Asuras the real warfare, the real battle. He comes to them to tell them, look, okay, you want to fight? Okay, I'll tell you what the real battle is. And of course, it's the battle over oneself. It's the battle with oneself. It's the victory over oneself. As the Buddha tells us in the Dhammapada, the victory over oneself is better than killing 1,000 men in battle 1,000 times. The real warfare, the real competition is within oneself, is with oneself. Throughout Buddhist texts, you get this warrior imagery used a great deal, especially the Buddha himself. It's used a great deal to describe the spiritual life. So if you're gripped by envy, competitiveness, look into yourself. You're not going to be satisfied by doing others down. That's not going to make you happy. So look again, look inside and think of the strategies. Plan the campaign. Do the deeds to rework and refashion yourself. It's interesting, in Islam we've heard a lot about jihad, haven't we, in recent years. But you know, in the Islamic tradition, especially in the Sufi tradition, they say the greater jihad, the greater holy war, the real holy war, is within oneself. It's within the soul. Sufis take this very seriously. The external jihad is not really a jihad at all. The real holy war is inside you. It's the life of intensive spiritual practice. So if we live such a life, instead of political machinations and elaborate military strategies, instead, we cultivate the all-accomplishing wisdom, the wisdom of a Buddha's skillful means. We start creating all kinds of ways for people to fulfill themselves, to attain the fruits of the wish-fulfilling tree, which is actually not found in the realm of the gods. The real wish-fulfilling tree, of course, is the bodhicitta, the enlightened mind, the mind of wisdom and compassion, the heart of wisdom and compassion, the essential union of wisdom and love. The bodhicitta is the wish-fulfilling tree because it gives satisfaction to everyone. It's for everyone. If you're thinking of happiness for yourself, you won't get the wish-fulfilling tree. But if you think of happiness for everyone, which is what the bodhicitta is about, you will get the wish-fulfilling tree. That is worth fighting for. That's worth striving for. And I'm deliberately using that language of fighting for and striving for because, you know, reading some books on Buddhism, you can get the impression that the spiritual life, that the Buddhist life, is about sort of suppressing and repressing and vanquishing our vigour and our energy, our ambition even. And that a spiritual person, a Buddhist person, is sort of meek and mild, soft and pliant, caring, very caring people. I don't mean real caring, I'm talking about caring. You know what I mean? I think you know what I mean. But Buddhist practice is about actually harnessing those ambitious, vigorous energies and transforming those energies. If you are competitive, and I think, you know, most people, most men I've met are intensely competitive, don't compete with others, but kind of compete against yourself. Do things well. Do things with real excellence. Have a very healthy sense of pride. Not that sort of, you know, that pride which comes from, you know, doing others down, but kind of healthy self-respect. Not doing it to say, well, look at me, but because you want to do things well for healthy self-respect. If you're ambitious, well, have real ambition, have the highest ambition, have the ambition to follow the bodhisattva path, have not self-centered ambition but selfless ambition. And I think it's particularly important to mention this sort of thing on a men's retreat, and I say that because of a conversation I had with a woman friend of mine recently, a Dharmacharini, a woman order member, good friend of mine, known her for many years, quite a strong woman with, quite a feminist background. And she was talking to me, we were chatting away, and she said she was concerned about men. And I said, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? She said, well, I've been on a lot of retreats lately, mixed retreats, and I'm not that impressed with the men. And I said, well, could you say a bit more about that? I said, well, they don't seem to be very comfortable with being men. They don't seem to be very comfortable with their positive masculinity. And she said, I don't mean that I think they should be macho, full of machismo or something like that, but just sort of straightforward, healthy sense of their male energy, their drive, their positive drive. So she said, what's going on? What do you think? We had a bit of a chat about it. So she told me she was quite shocked at herself for thinking this. She said she realised that she liked being with men who she could respect because they're comfortable with being men. And she said it's really strange having these thoughts because she never thought she'd think them because of her very staunchly feminist background. And I found that it was really interesting to have that conversation. So whilst we want to have nothing to do with competitive, envious, aggressive, warring gods with machismo, that's such an ugly, nasty state, that doesn't mean that we don't have positively directed energy and capability. It's interesting that the wisdom that you transform the envious asura energy into is this all-accomplishing wisdom of the Buddha Amogha Siddhi, unobstructed success. Siddhi can mean success, unobstructed success, who dwells in the pure land of the matrix of enlightened activities. So the impression you get there is of supreme capability, effectiveness, beneficence, expressive of the deepest, profoundest values, expressive of reality. Enlightenment, spiritual life, isn't about becoming sort of inert and rather sort of fey and distant and disconnected. It's about being really effective in your life, very creative in your life. So we're going to jump again. We're going to move from the fifth to the seventh day. And on the seventh day, there is yet another showing of reality, another vision. This time, the visionary showing is not of a Buddha. What comes now from all the directions of space are five figures called Vidyadharas. Vidyadhara can be translated as holders of magical knowledge. There's a white Vidyadhara, a yellow Vidyadhara, a red Vidyadhara, a green Vidyadhara, and a rainbow-coloured Vidyadhara. And these Vidyadharas are not sitting down, they're standing. Their legs are sort of striding. They're embracing a consort. They're majestic, strong figures, sublime figures, and they're wrathfully smiling. So they have a smile, definitely smiling, but there's some wrath there. And they come in the midst of coloured lights, and they come with a kind of crowd of different kinds of spiritual beings. I'll say more about the Vidyadharas a little later. From these Vidyadharas, rainbow-coloured lights stream forth to one's heart in sort of coloured threads, weaving and spiralling and pulsing and shimmering. And again, the lights are awesome and overwhelming. And this rainbow light is said to be the light of our innate, pristine wisdom. And at the same time as this light shines, a soft, dull, green light shines, indicative of the animal realm. And that dull green light is very attractive, it's very cozy looking, looks very comforting. And under the influence of our ignorance, our avidya, our habitual ignorance, we want to go towards the dull green light. And again, the Lama reading from the book urges us not to go there. He says, if you follow it, if you follow that soft green light, that cosy, dull green light, you're going to be reborn in the animal realm, the realm of ignorance and unknowing and unawareness. So ignorance, confusion, unawareness is another habitual set of responses to the space of the bardo. Another way of trying to deal with reality, with the onset of reality. We hide so regularly in ignorance and dullness. You sometimes see it in relationships. People change in relationships. They start speaking differently to us. They start perhaps saying for the first time what they really think. Perhaps they start indicating the truth. It actually starts feeling that what they're saying is right about the relationship, about us. And we can very quickly take refuge in confusion. We create a kind of fog. A cloud kind of comes over us. We space out. We babble. We go into a fog. Anything but to be clear. Anything but to actually hear and listen to what's being said. You think of your own examples, how you cloud things over, how you cloud to obscure the space. Sometimes you can have the experience, it's easier to see it in others than yourself, isn't it? Where you've told somebody repeatedly something, that you're not going to do something, and they just haven't heard it. They say, you never told me? And you've been saying it for day after day after day. They've kind of clouded it, obscured it. They're obscured by clouds. So this can be what sloth and torpor and dullness can be about in meditation practice. There can be times when we meditate, we go through periods when every time we sit down, we're just enveloped in dullness and sloth and sleep. And it's really weird because beforehand we felt really fresh. We maybe even had a nap beforehand. We go along to the meditation, start to concentrate, and we're off. What Sirita calls noddy in Toyland. You're just nodding the whole time. So this sloth, this can be the manifestation of ignorance, of not wanting to know what is going on within us, not wanting to know who we are, what's happening, what's opening up. So the realm where ignorance and unawareness predominates is the realm of the animals. Animals, of course, are trapped in the senses. They have no ability or very little ability to reflect. They can't stand back from experience, so they're just driven along by appetite. The animal realm is the realm of instinct. It's the realm that revolves around survival, around eating, sleeping, reproduction, and nothing else. People can get very sentimental, of course, about animals, but the realm of animals is a realm of very great suffering. And Tibetan Buddhist texts list the sufferings of the animal realm in quite graphic detail, including, of course, the suffering that's visited upon animals when they're employed by men. That they're beasts of burden, goaded by whips and ill-used, or even in the modern world, with some domestic pets, almost made taking on the neurosis of their owners, neurotic dogs, one thinks of. I can remember seeing two different elephants in India once. It really brought home to me the suffering of the ill-used animal. I remember passing an elephant on the road that was a beast of burden, basically. And he looked so... obviously I'm projecting, but he really did look sad. His eyes actually looked sad. I managed to get quite close, just sort of being driven along. And I saw another elephant that was a temple elephant, that was larking around in a stream, and very, very different animal. So animals suffer. They suffer greatly. We too are animals, of course. We have an animal nature. We have to eat, we sleep, we reproduce, we survive. We have animal instincts. And it's very important to be aware of that. And, we're probably more animal-like than we like to think we are. You know, if we have a good look at ourselves sometimes, you can say, well, actually, most of my concerns revolve around eating, around comfort, around survival, around sex, around sleep. Probably it happens a lot more than we like to think. Sometimes those things can be the main preoccupation. There's very little awareness beyond that. It might all be a bit tarted up, but that's basically what it is. We're just kind of locked into that stolid world of toil, survival, eating, sleeping, having sex, with nothing else beyond it, nothing higher. So we're not, in a way, fully human. Maybe there's a bit of human dress to make it kind of acceptable to ourselves. You know, and we can very quickly revert to our animal nature. I never forget the time I saw a group of men in India turn into a pack. Something had happened, they were attacking one person. And I was looking at these guys and I realised they weren't human anymore. They looked like a pack of dogs. You see packs of dogs in India kind of going for something. These men look like that. They'd ceased to be human in that moment. In the animal realm, great compassion manifests as the Blue Buddha Dhruva Singha, or Stira Singha, the dependable lion. And he holds out to the animals a book. He holds out the book of knowledge, the book of culture, the book of wisdom. When we're locked into a life that revolves around toil, survival, eating, sleeping, reproducing, we need to cultivate culture, knowledge, science. Actually, we need to civilize ourselves. We need to cultivate distinctively human consciousness. It's very interesting to look at the Tibetans themselves. They describe themselves in their own literature that before Buddhism came to Tibet, they describe themselves as the land of the red-faced savages. And they say, and you know, the different historical records seem to indicate this, that it was a very, very barbaric world. Some people think it was a miracle that Buddhism actually took root in Tibet. Before Buddhism came, there was no literature, there was no script, there was no writing even. There was no, as it were, higher culture. Buddhism had to bring all that to Tibet. It had to bring everything, literature, art, culture. It's even said that Buddhism helped in forming the first laws of the country to create a more, you know, some sort of stable society. Had to do all that because without it, the higher spiritual path was just not possible. People have just been locked in ignorance and savagery. I think in this connection of Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of the so-called untouchable people in India. I don't like using that word, but it's important to use it in this context. Think of what he did for his people. In Dr. Ambedkar's day, you know, when he appeared on the scene, and certainly before him, people in those communities were living barely better than animals. Living in the worst part of the village. Certainly Dr. Ambedkar's community, their job was to be sort of slaves, to be at the beck and call of the higher castes. They had the worst land, they had the worst water. They had one right. The only right they had was they could take the dead animals. If a buffalo died or a cow died, then they could have that for their food. You know, an old, you know, rotten animal. And my Buddhist friends, because many of these people converted to Buddhism, used to tell me that, you know, there would be an incredible fight, you know, when an animal died, you know, in the field. You know, there'd be a kind of fight between people within the community to get the meat. That's the world that these people were doomed to by the Hindu caste system. And one of Dr. Ambedkar's first tasks was to give his people education in the broadest sense, to give them knowledge, learning, culture. He liked that slogan, educate, agitate, organise. You know, education first of all, raise awareness, and then out of that, agitation and organisation. education so that people could articulate and express their aspirations, to actually realise that they had human aspirations. The first paper Dr. Ambedkar published was called Mook Nayak, which means voice of the dumb, which is incredibly expressive, you know, what he saw, you know, his people as being, that in a way, well, they had no voice, they were dumb. He was giving them a voice to express their humanity. Art, culture, poetry, literature, drama, painting, music, science, philosophy, they're just so incredibly important, so that we can express ourselves more fully, more finely, with greater nuance and shades of meaning, so that we can communicate our distinctively human consciousness and awareness. And through these things, we can broaden and enrich our awareness. Some Buddhist texts, well, many Buddhist texts, will be kind of seen very critical of intellect, of thinking. You know, you're always being told to go beyond thought. And some people love this. They love this thing of business of going beyond thought, going beyond thinking. But for the wrong reasons. Entirely the wrong reasons. Because they don't want to think. When you think, you have to work. You know, you have to actually do something when you think. And very often, going beyond the intellect is just, that sort of language. It's just an excuse for laziness, intellectual laziness. Buddhism doesn't encourage, as Dogen says, stupidity. It doesn't encourage a sort of cow-like stupidity, where you sink below thought. You need intellect, you need to think, you need to reason, you need to work with your mind before you can go beyond the intellect, go beyond thought. All that going beyond comes out of a progressive refinement of thinking, a refinement of intellect and intelligence. And intellect, intelligence, reason are incredibly precious things. They're very special human faculties, extraordinarily important. Those things enable us to step outside of sense experience, step outside of ourselves. Through thinking, you can actually start to, you know, you can reflect that, well, this is the classic Buddhist reflection, I know that I want to be happy and I want to avoid suffering. That's what I want. That's what I want in life. He and he deep down want exactly the same thing. If that's true of me when I come down to it, that's what I want, well, that's true of him. Well, that's reason doing that. And of course, if you bring the imagination in, another distinctively human quality, you can imagine yourself as another person. So thought, intellect, reason are extraordinarily important things. Through using them, we can learn and grow as human beings, as Buddhists. So we must be very careful not to sort of despise thinking. It doesn't mean we have to be some incredible intellectual or something like that. We've all got these faculties, but they need to be employed and not despised. The alternative to following the dull green light of ignorance to the realm of the animals is to respond to the rainbow-coloured wisdom light of the Vidyadharas. Vidyadharas are the holders of magical knowledge. Vidya means knowledge. It means wisdom. It is, of course, the opposite of avidya, ignorance. But vidya here is understood as knowledge or wisdom in a very special sense. It kind of includes the kind of ordinary senses of it, but it has kind of magical connotations. It's special, privileged knowledge. All existence, after all, is maya, a magical display, an illusory display. It's insubstantial, like rainbows appearing and disappearing. That's the way the enlightened man sees things. Well, when you live in this, you have magical knowledge. You become Vidyadhara, the holder of magical knowledge. And the Vidyadhara is said to be, in particular in the Tantric tradition, the divine form of the Tantric Guru. Sublime, majestic, powerful, with legs astride and long hair and ornaments, in a mass of rainbows, and kind of fiercely, wrathfully smiling. Padmasambhava is a Vidyadhara. And as you can see in the painting here, I think this painting draws out in particular Padmasambhava as Vidyadhara. He's very handsome, he has very strong features, yet if you look at those features, he seems to be, you know, frowning in some way, yet there's tenderness, kindness, love, alertness there, and he's wearing those lovely colourful robes, he's holding his vajra and skull cup and trident, and he is the master of all existence. This is one of his names, the sovereign of all existence, the conqueror of all existence. The Vidyadhara, Padmasambhava, is the master of all forces, all the energies of existence. You see all those drops and of light there, kind of indicating that. Padmasambhava is the master of all the energies of existence because he's cut through the solidity of appearances. So all experience is completely malleable to him. So the Tantric Guru, the Vidyadhara, is a master, it said, of all spiritual paths, of all arts and sciences, and he can employ all this highly effectively for the benefit of others. So the Vidyadhara is said to be the master communicator of the Dharma. The Vidyadharas, in fact, are said to be associated with the speech centre. So the Vidyadharas can communicate the Dharma in every possible way for the benefit of their disciples. The Vidyadhara will love, will bless, will initiate, will inspire, will energize, will challenge, will provoke. He will clarify, he will expound, he will enrich, he will provide people with effective spiritual practices, effective spiritual environments. He will even, at times, just leave you to yourself. If you read the life of Guru Padmasambhava, this is exactly the way Padmasambhava did behaved among the Tibetans. And it wasn't just about having one-on-one, so to speak. We love the idea of having a one-on-one relationship with someone so special like a Vidyadhara, like Padmasambhava, you know, have a special guru because we're a special person. What Padmasambhava did, in fact, was to create and inspire and initiate a spiritual community, the community of his great disciples, and out of that he inspired a whole Buddhist culture. So we can say that the realm of the Vidyadharas is the realm of intense communication of the Dharma on all levels, on the verbal level, the symbolic level, on the mind-to-mind level. And the realm of the Vidyadhara will arise when we practice the Dharma together intensively, where all our communication is an exploration of the Dharma. Don't have to necessarily be talking about Buddhist ideas, Buddhist context, but there's this intense exploration of the Dharma together, and then the magical transformations can happen. It will arise as well, the realm of the Vidyadhara, out of our intense practice and of our deep spiritual yearning and longing. And I'm going to conclude with a reading by one of Sangharakshita's teachers, the great Dujom Rinpoche, who was the head of the Nyingma school before he died, who is a Vidyadhara himself, widely regarded. And what I'm going to read is a translation of a song that he composed for a feast gathering of all his disciples, a song of yearning, a song of longing to enter the realm of the Vidyadharas, the realm of Padmasambhava on his copper-coloured mountain, his pure land. So I'll read this with the aspiration that this world, this place, may become like the realm of Vidyadhara. How amazing! In the centre of the palace, on the highest copper-coloured mountain, an assembly of Vidyadharas, Dharkas and Dharkanis gathered together, their 100 moods of great exaltation captivate with playful, charming grace. Thinking of them deep in my heart, I recall my soul father, Guru Padmasambhava. the vivid splendour of your body in form, the form body arrayed with the major and minor marks of physical perfection, overwhelms other appearances in existence. Your melodious speech of the great secret channel is a lute sweet sound, and your sublime mind has the nature of undefiled luminous wisdom. What can rival this feast, seeing the Guru's beaming face? My hope to gaze again and again is unbearable. Such a wonderful sight. Sweet smiles with loving sidelong glances as I listen to Dakini's sweet secret words in symbolic songs, and they sway in swift dances. Yet cataracts of dense stains of dualistic thought cover the young water bubble eyes of this wretched child. I have no chance to see this marvel. Despondent with regret, I call out in lament, Padmasambhava, do you hear me? If you hear me, take your golden scalpel of wisdom and compassion and remove the shell of the thick veil of my ignorance. Actually take my forefinger and please lead me to the realm of my soul father, a delightful pleasure grove. If I am without the fortune to be led there immediately, send Vidyadharas, Dharkas and Dharkanis as companions to console me. In joyful delight, I will participate in glorious festivals of untainted great exaltation and gradually follow my father. My body, a white eagle swelling with the youth of threefold faith, has wings of the view and conduct in unison. When the six powers of perfectly pure tantric commitments are complete, the city of lotus light will not be so far away. My male and female divine companions, a group who shares the same karma and good fortune, make prayers of aspiration to join the ranks of Vidyadharas. In an exultant mood, with joyful laughter, let us set out together, never separating, for the terrestrial Pure Land. Thus a song of yearning arises of itself in this young cuckoo's melodious voice, sung in my throat's energy centre of rapture's playful display, a messenger to invoke my teacher's wisdom mind. Send down the gentle nectar shower of your blessings.